Crash of the Migrants, an excerpt from Woman Watching, Louise de Caroline Lawrence and the Songbirds of Pimlico Bay by Marilyn Simons. The spring of 1956 was slow to arrive. April had been cold with heavy snows. At the end of the month, the ice on the bay was still solid. The spring migration seemed off-kilter. Louise knew by then exactly when to expect each species to arrive, but even so she double-checked her records. The few migratory birds that landed in her woods that spring were 5 to 11 days late. On May the 2nd, the weather warmed briefly, and a thin stream of migrants trickled in. Robins, flickers, geese, ducks, white-throated sparrows, even a few barn swallows. The vast flocks were stalled, Louise assumed, somewhere to the south. The birds that did arrive pecked in the snow for seeds and bugs, but the insects weren't there. It was still too cold. The ice finally went out of Pimlico Bay on May the 7th, the latest day the lake had ever cleared. But the next day was so cold that new ice formed along the shore. The mass of polar air that had moved in during the night hung over Louise's forest for almost a week. The snow stayed crisp and deep. She watched as a flock of swallows turned in the teeth of the cold wind and headed south again. "But I do not know how far they went," she wrote. "Perhaps only a mile or two out of the worst rage of the elements. There's a lot in nature that you only think you know because it seems logical, but many things do not happen as you think they ought." On May the 11th, warm air flooded in, and within hours the temperature rose to 28 degrees Celsius. The buds on the trees swelled, insects hatched. Every morning and evening, Louise watched with anxious anticipation, but the wave of expected migrants did not appear. They were flying high above, she assumed, madly making up for lost time as they pushed farther north. On the night of May 15th, when another Arctic cold front shoved temperatures back below freezing and covered the ground with snow, the birds came down. By 9 o'clock in the morning, she wrote, a great mass of migrating birds overran the whole countryside. They came on this day not through the trees, but crawling, hopping stiffly from straw to dead leaf, covering the ground with their bodies. They wallowed in the snow, looking for food that scarcely was there, or sat cold and shivering, trying to warm their freezing feet in the soft feathers of their bellies. Thrushes came in great numbers, fawn-colored veeries, silent hermit thrushes in no mood for any characteristic light lift of their rust-red tails. There were gray-cheeked thrushes. Never before or since have I seen so many of these rare thrushes that belong to the land from James Bay to Labrador and are glimpsed only occasionally on their passage through these parts. On this day, they came down from the skies in a veritable avalanche. Ovenbirds walked all over the forest floor and in places sheltered from the snow, turned over the dead leaves one by one, looking for a snail, a mite, whatever edible thing the leaf might cover. Nashville warblers, bright yellow dots in the snow, fed ravenously upon the yellow stamens of the pussy willows. And least flycatchers, feeling the cold badly with their utter dependence on winged insect life, hopped dismally from one grass blade to another, close, close, close to the ground. They were too bone cold to take any notice of me, stepping cautiously among them, lest inadvertently I should trample one underfoot. At 11 o'clock that morning, the birds were still coming on, crawling northward along the ground. They covered the roadsides and the wires of the guardrails in great numbers. Thrushes and more thrushes, white-crowned and white-throated sparrows, rose-breasted grosbeaks. All through the day, the birds moved slowly and laboriously northward, across the Pimlico Bay region, in the teeth of the piercing wind, hugging the ground, seeking what scant shelter there was to be found from the icy blasts. As night came, it grew colder and colder. A ruby-throated hummingbird, rebuffed by the wind, fell on the cold cement foundation of the house and clung there for a long, miserable minute, then miraculously found strength to lift upon vibrating wings, hovering along our windows, then disappeared toward the north in the gathering dusk. It froze hard during the night. As dawn came, the flycatchers and the warblers had tracelessly disappeared. The greater mass of these birds that came into this region on that dreadful day, crawling onward, dominated by the urgency to reach their well-known breeding grounds, powered by their last ergon of energy, must have perished. But the thrushes and the sparrows, hardier than the insect eaters, survived. They flocked to the feeding station. The white-crowned sparrows, proud birds of the far north, interrupted all their activities with song. They sang as they fed greedily upon the ground, as they rested, as they preened, as they chased one another through the trees. Having thus come upon the rigorous conditions they would undoubtedly meet on the tundra, the goal of their journey, perhaps they thrilled to the illusory feeling of having already arrived and expressed it in the most enchanting chorus of haunting, plaintive melodies ever heard in these parts. There was frost every night and often snow as one cold front after another pressed down on Louise's woods. By the third week in May, the trees were still without leaves. She spent most of her time making food for the birds, suet balls, breadcrumbs, and seeds suited to the species that were invading her small wilderness, some of them quite uncommon. Many clearly had never dined on human-made food. They didn't even recognize it as food, but they were starving. They saw other birds devouring the tidbits, and having no choice, they ate it too. Louise watched horrified, yet mesmerized by the irresistible migratory urge that had brought the birds to this crisis, by the behaviors the disaster provoked. Some are adaptive to emergency situations, he wrote, and some are not. And those that are not do not survive. Thus, those that have the power to live on, the gift of adjustment, endow their progeny with some of their adaptive abilities. And so the 7 days of creation goes on eternally before our very eyes. For 10 more days, the murderous cold persisted, and still the birds came. They came in straggling groups through the days, wrote Louise, always traveling close to the ground, never once ascending into the treetops, their habitual stratum. Low-flying insects grounded the birds more than the cold itself, and judging by the behavior of the crawling birds, there were not many of these. At one time, I nearly stepped on a tiny orange-crowned warbler sitting huddled by a small tuft of grass. Untold numbers of woodland songbirds died of starvation and exposure that spring. Members of Louise's Nipissing Naturalist Club picked up dozens of dead birds from around the lakes west of Pimisi Bay. Hundreds more were never recovered. In the forest, she wrote, they fell into the leaves as they reached the inevitable end of their journey, upon the beds of green mosses and forest debris, and nature took care of their tiny bodies and buried them, unseen and uncounted.